Welcome to In Search of Black Power. I'm Lawrence Grand Prix, Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots think tank based in Baltimore City.
I'm Rasheem, independent scholar and researcher.
So today we wanted to talk about reparations and specifically some of the mythologies around reparations and how we can apply reparations to very material issues happening in our communities, specifically the war on drugs. So I've been working on this issue really since 2014. And when I realized cannabis was going to be legal in almost every state, and as not really a consumer, my thing I realized was that they're going to be taxing that cannabis and making millions of dollars in state tax revenue. And we need to redistribute that to the people's impact by the war on drugs. So back in 2014, that was my initial focus. And even back then, saying the word reparations was completely taboo in mainstream American politics. It was the third rail. You were crazy. You was messing with Farrakhan and them.
You were like, too you were militant. Toxic. Yeah.
So when the 2020 Democratic primary happened, it was very, very interesting because a complete shift had happened in the discourse where many, many mainstream Democratic Party presidential candidates started presenting, not just saying we should talk about reparations, but presenting their plans for reparations. So as a person who does material work on the ground, I'm like, nothing has fundamentally shifted in terms of people's lack of willingness to invest in grassroots Black political power. They don't want that. So why is everybody talking about reparations? And when you start to look at the plans that Warren, Beto, all these other folks presented, Castro, nothing in those plans had anything to do with what I considered the heart of what reparations truly was. Investing in independent Black institutions so we no longer need white institutions to govern our lives. They were all the exact opposite. They were all saying we should give all the money to the existing white institutions to do more stuff for Black people. And that came really clear to me because I judge and coach debate, done it for 15 years. With the pandemic, it's all virtual. So I'm judging virtual college debates around social justice issues. Topic is reparations. This team, so happy, feels so good and so woke to talk about defending reparations in debate. And their definition of reparations was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. An Elizabeth Warren special that basically just talks about consumers like being charged more money when you're Black for stuff. And it's like our imagination around reparations has become so shriveled up that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is seen as a legitimate example of reparations for, again, these are the future elites of America. These are the people who are going to run the world, and they actually think that's reparations. And I think that it just made it so important for me to try to have some specific conversations around the approach that someone like LBS takes, as someone, an organization that does grassroots political work at a very concrete material state and local level, but has a larger Pan-African nationalist, Black nationalist approach to reparations, right?
One of the things I'm really looking forward to around this talk, as I look back at the article that you wrote in 2020 on this topic, is really engaging with some of those myths and just kind of like breaking them down and critiquing them one by one.
Yeah. And so before we get to the specifics of the conversation, because what I want to do is first answer the basic fundamental question: how do we bust some of the myths around cannabis legalization towards a vision of reparations which empowers the grassroots over the nonprofit industrial complex? So as a central guide star for our conversation, that's what I'm trying to do. And so before I can get to that, I have to address the first of the four myths that we're going to talk about today, which is myth number one, is that there is an ironclad cross-racial and cross-class consensus around cannabis legalization. And anyone who challenges legalization must be reactionary and be dismissed. So what do you think about that?
I mean, I think on the face of it, I can see why that would be something that people believe. Like, why would you challenge it? What if you challenge it, what is wrong with you? Are you not for decriminalization. Mm-hmm. You know,
do you not believe in the war on drugs?
Right. Do you not? Exactly.
So people, again, Fox News, you must be a conservative. Mm-hmm. In my experience, that's not the reality. And I think even some of the people watching this talk may have questions. Because what I've heard people say is that, look, we know the government pushes drugs on us. Mm-hmm. We know that the government would want us high all the time to not actually be fighting oppression. And we know that this is a multi-billion dollar industry that they want to push into our communities. Mm-hmm. So there are legitimate, serious concerns that, again, usually working class Black folks have. But what people say, again, either liberal, progressive, nonprofit types, is, oh, those are just old conservative people. They just have an obsession with their home values. These are the homeowners associations. Just ignore them, right? And that's, mm-hmm. that doesn't work for Black folks. Because mm-hmm. these are folks in our communities where the white progressives don't have to care about that.
Right.
So where I think the argument goes too far, and this is what's happening in Maryland right now, is that people use these sort of convoluted public safety arguments to defend cannabis prohibition. They even say things like, well, the cops, when they search for weed, they find guns. So mm-hmm. we need to keep weed illegal because we need to find the guns because people be shooting each other. Mm. And I also think, again, that the liberal progressive establishment doesn't listen to this argument, doesn't have a good answer to it, because the centrality of dealing with violence is such an important issue for so many in our community, they can be persuaded by this argument. The reality, of course, is the exact opposite. Cops are using so much of their energy looking for weed, looking for these small bags of drugs, they don't actually even know how to do investigations on the extremely small percentage of people that drive the violence in our communities, mm-hmm. which are not everyday people selling drugs. These are people who are often paid shooters, who can afford great lawyers, and who usually get off, not because the judge is crooked, but because our cops don't know how to do detective work mm-hmm. or investigations, because all they know how to do is do the war on drug stuff. Mm-hmm. So the reality is that the war on drugs has become an excuse for cops not to do the one job that even abolitionists admit that they need to do, is deal with a small percentage of violent people, and that we need to actually invest in the community, violence prevention from the bottom up, and stop allowing these public safety arguments to overcoat the conversation. But when you just ignore the public safety arguments, you make Black people feel like you don't care about the violence happening in our community, which mm-hmm. actually works against the legalization movement. So the last thing I think that needs to be said on this point is there is real concern amongst people who feel like, yeah, we know people smoke weed. We know prohibition doesn't stop people from using weed. Yeah, I guess it should be legal. But I just don't like the fact that people seem to be smoking or using opioids or whatever to escape from reality. Mm. And we in our community, it's like, yeah, maybe legalize it because it's better to be legal than illegal. But what are you doing about the hopelessness in our community? Mm-hmm. And to call that reactionary old fogyism, I think, is a huge mistake. Because with legalization, what we can do is actually begin to incubate the people who have an African-centered perspective around addiction, who understand that drugs can be a flight from the reality of racism, and present reparative programming to actually deal with that. And we also can have people who know how to use the cannabis plant, not in just a recreational way, not just in an escapist way, but also in a sacramental and sacred way.
Right.
So the views and the indigenous cultural practices of the Rastafarians and other people in our community to be able actually to find ways to use the plant as a tool of liberation. But that can't happen without legalization. And that really can't happen unless we get the tax revenue injected back into our communities to incubate those practices. And again, that's where a lot of the liberal, progressive legalization advocates, they're not nearly as loud on that as we should get to smoke, right?
Right.
So the second myth is around getting people out of jail who are in jail around cannabis. I think this seems like a point where there should be no debate. People are in jail for something that white people are about to make millions of dollars doing. So the common argument, which I call a myth, goes something like this. A massive percentage of the people in jail are in jail for low-level drug possession offenses. We can easily let them out and eliminate their criminal records. The only problem is people don't want to.
Yeah.
So
I can tell you, when I read that part and I saw those percentages, I was pretty shocked that the percentages were so low. One, the amount of folks that are in jail on those type of drug charges, and then the amount that are actually low level Like what, like 5 to 6%?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be, I'm not against letting those folks out. What I would say in terms of the argument is like, that does not, that's not going to make a dent or the impact that exactly. I feel like the narrative tries exactly. to say it'll make.
So I call this the liberal proceduralist vision of operations.
Mm.
All we got to do is change some policy around, tweak some stuff within the system, and it'll all be good.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of comes from that, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which talked a lot about low-level drug possession offenders driving mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Problem is, that's federal prison, not state prisons and jails, which is what most people are in. And that's 10 years old at this point.
Mm.
So at this point, a lot of the low-hanging fruit, people who are just in jail for a bag of weed, a lot of those mm-hmm. folks are out.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been out for a while. So if you look to the work of Professor John Paff in his 2017 book, Locked In, he says that, again, the site that you were stating, in reality, only about 16% of state prisoners are serving time on drug charges. And very few of them, perhaps only around 5 to 6% of that group, are both low-level and nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, more than half of all people in state prisons have been convicted of a violent crime. A strategy based on decriminalizing drugs will thus disappoint and disappoint significantly. So this is the reality of when you get charged. Anybody ever been to the system knows you don't usually get charged for one thing.
No.
You get charged for loitering, second-degree assault.
It's a lot of overcharging.
Exactly, a lot of overcharging, resisting arrest,
mm-hmm.
right? And so a second-degree assault charge can just be like a shoving match, you know, showing something at somebody, and that's a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
So when, and this is how stuff works in the real world of advocacy. We go to Annapolis, we go to the state capitol, and what happens is, the cannabis people don't know any of this. So they pass a bill that expunges low-level possession charges.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stand on the courthouse steps and they wave the bill. And they say, we have overcome.
Right.
And that actually gives the politicians cover to not do the stuff that we be talking about, which mm-hmm. is dealing with the people that have a more complex record, the people that have been charged in a unit. And so the cannabis advocates have actually alienated a ton of grassroots black and brown advocates because they don't seem to actually understand the complexity of the reality people are facing. And the other reality is that much as we want to romanticize or we feel like we're helping the issue by acting like people that sell drugs have nothing to do with people who carry guns, a lot of people in our community can't get a legal gun. Because mm-hmm. if you have a minor charge on you as a kid, hanging with the wrong crowd, got caught up in a sweep, in Maryland you can't get a legal gun.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who are not shooters, who are, let's say you work in contracting, you work as a party promoter. You work doing catering. If you work in a cash industry
mm-hmm.
and you don't feel like the police will protect you, there's a real possibility that you want people to know that you carry a gun
yeah.
as a method of self-defense because you can't afford to get robbed because
mm-hmm.
then your family's out on the street. They can't pay their light bill. They can't pay their rent. So there are a lot of people who have illegal guns that mm-hmm. are in jail for the violent crime of illegal gun possession. Not drug possession, but gun possession, who are not really public safety threats and drivers of the violence.
Mm-hmm.
But the liberal, progressive, nonprofit community, the same people that tell you that the Consumer Protection Bureau is reparations, they don't want to talk about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it actually was a book written by the journalist Matt Taibbi. He was actually interviewing a pretty big-time weed seller who used a pseudonym. He called himself Hubie Carmichael. It's called The Business Secrets of Drug Dealing. He talks about gun carrying in the cannabis illegal space. And he says in this business, you never touch a gun if you don't have to. Never have one around. Never show one to a girlfriend. Never take one to a range or to the woods. It's too much power. It leads you to use it somehow. On the other hand, you have to have people around you who have them. Ain't no courtroom in this business. You got a problem with someone, there's no filing a lawsuit. You need people who can handle themselves or else you'll be up proverbial Schitt's Creek and fast.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like we talk about white people, a lot of them were in the illegal economy too, but they just had the connections to launder their money out of the illegal economy, while a lot of our black folks don't.
Right.
A lot of them are still in jail because they may have been the friend who had the gun, or they may have been caught up in like a RICO case, like a combined conspiracy case with mm-hmm. the person who had the gun, when the white folks are able to get out of that. So this whole idea that all we gotta do is decriminalize retroactively, carrying a bag of weed and everything's gonna be good. The reality is we need grassroots sustained political pressure to deal with this false dichotomy between violent and nonviolent drug offenders. right? And unfortunately, again, I think people just feel like all we need is this tiny technocratic fix and it'll all be better. But mm-hmm. we need grassroots political pressure to actually make those changes stick.
Yeah. One of the things that I really appreciated as I was looking over is like looking at the ways in which there is this street business structure, and even in the way that you were reading that, how he's saying you never touch a gun, but mm-hmm. you still need, like, for protection purposes. And you also identify, like, these folks aren't shooters, they aren't necessarily violent, but you are in a particular business where you still need to protect yourself, just like people who tow cars or people mm-hmm. who are party promoters or a bouncer or that sort of thing. Yeah.
And I think that when people think of the Black community, again, a lot of times they project this emptiness and this void upon us. And one thing I realized is that when you actually look at the statistics about Black people, the actual business creation statistics are pretty low. Mm. But that's not because Black people aren't doing business. It's just because we don't have an LLC. There are a lot of great, not necessarily Black market, like illegal organized drug kingpins. But mm-hmm. like, again, I have a friend who might do catering, mm-hmm. party promotion, event planning, roofing, landscaping, and they're just running a business, but they're not, they don't have a formal legal LLC.
Right.
So there's just a ton of economic activity that's driving our community that the dominant academic and political sphere knows nothing about because mm-hmm. they don't study it, because mm-hmm. they just assume we're all down bad and broke.
Right.
So on the flip side, I think that's what a lot of us to believe that all we have to do is turn that hustle into a legal hustle. And that because there's so much money in cannabis, that itself could be the mechanism of reparations. Mm. So that kind of leads to the third myth I wanted to bust, which is basically like the Black capitalist reparations myth. And it goes something like this, right? So it's like, cannabis is the new gold rush. White people are becoming millionaires. This is our opportunity for Black folks to become wealthy and secure an industry which we were criminalized for participating in to produce generational wealth for our community.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of those things that it doesn't really tackle are the barriers to entry, how much they start to get caught off, started up, and then like what level or what type of involvement are you going to have in the cannabis industry? Are you having a whole farm? Mm-hmm. Are you having, you know, there's different, several different levels and barriers to entry.
And I kind of frame it through the lens of as a difference between horticulture and agriculture.
Okay.
Horticulture is like when you got a couple of plants in your house and you're putting in the leaves for your, you know, your daisies or whatever.
Right.
Agriculture is like you got a farm.
Right.
And you got like all the pesticides and the thresher and like, mm-hmm. you know, like the big farm in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Like when you talk about servicing a legal cannabis economy for an entire state, you're not doing that with, you know, a couple of grow lights and some hydroponics in your closet.
Right.
Right. You need a farm.
Yeah.
And farms cost multiple millions of dollars. Right. So the reality is that when we talk about reparations, who I'm talking about are the people who were directly impacted by the war on drugs and really working class and poor Black people. Because there are middle class, upper class Black folks that sold weed, you know, had edibles in your backpack at college. Mm-hmm. And those folks might be able to transition to run a dispensary, mm-hmm. right? But that's mm-hmm. not the majority of people in Baltimore, mm-hmm. right? That I'm talking about. I'm talking about working class Black folks that, again, may have been in an environment where they had to carry a gun, may have been in an environment where they got into fights. And when I think people in Baltimore hear reparations, they assume it's people like that getting out of jail mm. and getting access to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know is that between the dispensaries and between the large-scale grow operations, what do you think, based upon just your perception in your brain, would be the startup capital you need to enter that industry?
Oh my gosh. What, for at like a farm?
Well, yeah, just like
millions.
Yeah, well,
how
like
many
a range,
acres we talking? Right, 10 million.
Exactly. So I think people in their minds, I don't know what they think. I don't mm-hmm. know if they think that it's less money or that the money is more available. Where I have been told that's one dispensary, just like a storefront, a dispensary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're looking somewhere at the range between, you know, 3 to 10 million.
Mm-hmm.
And to run a full scale grow operation, you're looking more at the range of, like, depending on the state, depending on all the expenses. But, like, you know, 10 to 50.
What about expenses as it relates to licensing and regulation and FDA?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's actually something I wanted to bring up. So we actually want to bring up this screenshot. And this is a screenshot produced by a cannabis consulting company. So take that with a grain of salt. They have an incentive to make you scared to make you feel like they need you need their services if you want to enter this space. Mm-hmm. But they actually present an economic breakdown of the cost of operating a cannabis dispensary compared to like a non-cannabis dispensary. So between like federal taxes, a lot of stuff that's tax deductible for other companies is not tax deductible for cannabis. Mm-hmm. So they have a higher federal tax bill. They have to think of things like banking fees. Most banks won't allow you to bank if you're doing cannabis. So you have to pay higher fees. If they know you're running a cannabis company, they charge you more for your real estate because of the risk and they think you've got it. You got to pay for closed circuit TV. Very specific cannabis tracking technology because the laws want you to track every single plant from when it's a seed to when it's in somebody's joint. Mm-hmm. Advertising, attorneys on retainer because, again, you can still get sued and shut down federally. So when you actually run the numbers, this dispensary in this projection was pulling down $1 million in total sales and the net profit after taxes was $45,000.
Wow.
That's how crazy the economics in the cannabis space actually are. And I know, again, this take it with a grain of salt. This is a consulting firm called North Star Financing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this is too far off from the reality that if you're touching the plant, you are subject to a world of issues. Now, there are smaller scale economic opportunities. Like you can run a head shop, sell rolling paper, sell glass. And incubating those things, you're not actually touching the plant, so you don't need special licenses and background checks and all this extra overhead.
What about for delivery?
That's actually a critical space. You will be touching the plant then. Mm. But several states, including Massachusetts, because people don't always go to the dispensary, especially with COVID. Mm-hmm. They get it delivered like Uber Eats. Now, Uber themselves have said they want to enter the cannabis space to run delivery systems.
Uh-huh.
Now, what we're saying, amongst other things, is that we need to ensure that we as a community have access to running our own transportation company so that can be a space specifically carved out for working class black folks who want to deliver cannabis to their community. Mm-hmm. But that goes along with security licenses. Like, who's going to do the security for these entities? Like, if it's going to be anywhere in a black neighborhood, you're going to need people with street cred to keep that business open. But in Maryland, you basically need to be a former cop to get a license to be a security person, right? So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that obviously the reparation stuff is more complicated, but when people think of reparations, I really do think they want some simplistic, cathartic, top-down vision. Mm-hmm. And it's these small, technocratic, tiny decisions that make a huge difference in terms of whether something concrete and tangible like cannabis legalization is going to actually be liberatory for our community or just be another thing where we get to run around and get the shaft. And I think that folks are so caught up in things like HR 40 and the federal conversation that these opportunities right in front of us get ignored. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are some folks who are like, you know, cannabis businesses, that's just black capitalism, I don't care. And there are some folks that are like, you know, state level policy is too small. It's not going to make a big enough dent. I feel like I'm doing more at a federal level. But again, if we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars flowing through not just the business side, but the tax revenue side. Really engaging these nuances is really important. And I feel like, again, when you get so caught up in the national conversation, the, you know, Kamala Harris talking about reparations and people glowing over that, it just kind of obscures these conversations.
Can you just speak a little bit to how these efforts would impact the cash-only street industry?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a big part of where I wanted to transition next is, in the piece I wrote, it basically talks about California and talks about, and this is becoming a theme, is that these perverse incentives, these things that you feel like will fix the problem and make the problem worse. Mm-hmm. So people think that with legalization, people who've been selling on the streets are going to have access to the legal economy. Now, we just explain why that's economically difficult. But also think of it like, if you are a street baller, you can't just go to the NBA. Mm-hmm. Like, they have the whole system. The game is different. You need agents. You need to have gone through college and all these elite camps. So it's a very different game from the legal economy, from the illegal economy, the street economy, to the formal economy. Mm-hmm. Like, they're looking for high technical levels of proficiency with technology and all types of stuff. Unfortunately, on top of that, what happens when you legalize cannabis, you create a powerful lobby that wants to decrease street sales. Mm. You have a potential alliance between the big cannabis companies who do not want street sales eating into their profits and the state government. Because the state government knows that illegal street sales cuts them off from the tax revenue that comes with legal sales. So we see states like California, where there's actually an increased focus on shutting down the black market post-legalization, after the very thing that people thought would be a savior for the people in the black markets is actually becoming a problem for them, right? And on top of that, in California, because of the way they wrote the bill, every state has wrote the bill differently. A huge chunk of the tax revenue from legal cannabis actually is going to local police departments in California. So it's the opposite of defund the police, actually being refunded by the thing that was sold to them as the cure for the war on drugs, which kind of gets me to the last myth I wanted to bust, which is about reinvesting the tax revenue that's created from cannabis legalization. Because small thing people may not realize that with medical cannabis, there's no added tax on medical cannabis. It's expensive, but not because of the added tax, because people say you're not supposed to tax medicine. But recreational cannabis, they tax it really heavy because they want the tax revenue. So with the pandemic, cannabis was deemed an essential service, and sales have actually boomed with people buying cannabis during the pandemic. So there are states like Illinois have hundreds of millions of dollars flowing through the cannabis tax sales going into state government. So this is the last myth, and I call it the progressive, multicultural, big state theory of reparations, right? Which is that reparations are about recognizing our suffering and those who have benefited from our oppression recognizing their privilege. They must sacrifice access to their privilege they have accumulated in order to make black people whole, right? And I think that's becoming a dominant model of how states are doing their reparations programs. So I'm just going to give you a few examples and conclude with the things that we're pushing as an alternative, right? So many of you probably heard about Illinois, and the city of Evanston, Illinois, is actually a suburb of Chicago. Evanston, basically, every city that sold legal cannabis got to put a small, call it piggyback tax. So you have the big state tax, you have a smaller local tax. So Evanston is an affluent suburb. Evanston is actually the suburb where Northwestern University is. Northwestern is one of the most elite universities in the country. It's where a ton of journalists go to school. So Evanston, again, liberal, multicultural, woke suburb, we're like, we're going to take our local tax revenue from cannabis legalization and invest it in reparations for slavery. And if defined reparations for slavery is, we'll help you get a down payment on the house, right? Now, again, think about the scale here. Evanston's a small community. We're talking about like $800,000. So you get a couple of, you know, $50,000 grants to help you put a down payment, which actually helps the Evanston housing market stabilize itself because you have less vacant housing stock, right? So you have a few black families potentially benefiting from this and a ton of media coverage. Hundreds of media pieces been written about the emotional debates in the Evanston City Council about recognizing my privilege and investing in black people's livelihoods, and I care about black bodies, Black Lives Matter. Meanwhile, the actual state of Illinois as a whole is making $150 million per year on cannabis tax sales. And people aren't even talking about the entire fund they have in the state capital of Springfield to redirect $30 to $60 million per year of tax revenue around the state as a reparations policy. So I just wanted to have that be an example of, we are allowing our emotional desire for catharsis and media fixation with white people's pain and angst around racism blind us to the actual political opportunities that are in our system.
Where are the reinvestments happening for, where are the reinvestments happening? How are they decided? For example, the participatory budgeting events, how is that money distributed, and how do we get it into those communities that are most impacted by the war on drugs?
That's a good question, because, I mean, that should really just be its own video. To try to be brief, I brought up Illinois because Illinois has a program called Restore, Reinvest, and Renew, called R3. And this program is being deemed as a national model to be copied around the country. So if you're in Maryland, Maryland's going to probably put cannabis to a referendum in 2022, which means that cannabis will not actually be sold until 2023. Many states are trying to use Illinois as a model about how they want to do their redistributive tax revenue in terms of the reparation stuff. Now, here's what Illinois did. Illinois basically had a bunch of political appointees come together to form a panel that was based in the state capital of Springfield that got a set of criteria that they basically used to open up requests for proposals around cannabis. And if you look at the actual request for proposal, you know, I'm one of the very few people outside of Illinois that actually studied the request for proposal. You can actually read the specific details about how they crafted the policy and how it basically shades the conversation towards a certain type of person, a certain type of nonprofit, which is not reparations. Mm. It's a form of investment, but it's an investment that fits within the mentality of the nonprofit industrial complex that mm-hmm. does not actually get to what I define as reparations at the top, which is the people who were aggrieved should choose for themselves the mechanism of redress for the harm.
Right.
Now, Illinois is selling this as that because they have three hand-selected returning citizens on this panel. But you can go to jail for a bunch of stuff. There are lots of folks who've been to jail who are part of the nonprofit industrial complex. When you have three of them and nine political appointees, and what are the marching orders they were actually given? The marching orders they were given, if you look at the actual screenshot, which I think we actually have available for our audience, says things like you have to have a public health approach. You have to use best practices. Actually says in other things, you have to have 3 years of audited financial statements. You have to have an evidence-based approach to things like gun violence and things like unemployment, child poverty. So again, a very deficit-based vision of reparations. It's not focused on inculcating independent institutions. Evidence-based means you already have had to been doing it.
Right.
And already have had to have someone study it. So it's an inherently conservative vision of how reparations should work. So basically, in public health, it's an industry dominated by academia. So if you have access to people with PhDs, they don't evaluate your program unless you're paying them. So you need to have lots of money to be able to pay for an evaluation of what you're doing. So all these subtle mechanisms basically shaded the program in Illinois towards larger nonprofits. And if you actually look at who got funded, again, I'm one of the very few people who studied the list extensively, and I don't have time to go over the whole list. You got people who are doing things like funding college scholarships and calling that violence prevention. Now, not to say that you can't go to school and be potentially in the streets, but that's not what I think most people think of as violence prevention. Yeah. They're thinking of actually walking the streets with people who are in the game and helping them provide services. And they're thinking of funding those people directly as opposed to forcing them, as they do in Illinois and as they do in Baltimore, to essentially go through the public health, nonprofit, industrial, academic complex to get permission, to get funded to do the work that we've been doing in the streets for decades, right? So Illinois, and the one thing that I found that could potentially show you how I think it was pretty silly who got money in Illinois, two things. First, they used the criteria of geographic diversity and poverty as who got money for the War on Drugs Reparation Fund.
Geographic diversity.
And poverty.
And poverty.
So there are towns getting money for the War on Drugs Reparations Fund that are 90% white.
Wow.
Because when you don't pay attention to the details and you get caught up in the emotions of something like Evanston. And I'm not saying that people in Evanston aren't trying to do good work. I'm saying when you get caught up there, if you actually do a comparative Google search, there are like 10 times more things written about Evanston than about the R3 program. Even though the R3 program is 50 times more money. This is how we as Black folks get caught in our emotional desire for our suffering to be recognized, as opposed to actually shifting power. But again, that's pretty ridiculous. The other thing that's ridiculous is that one of the people who got money for Illinois' cannabis reparations program was the National Diversity and Cannabis Inclusion Initiative, the NDCIA. This is about getting Black folks access to the industry, which again is like whatever. But who is on the board of the NDCIA? It's none other than Freeway Ricky Ross himself.
What?
Not the rapper, but the real
Ricky Ross. The real Ricky. Wow.
Right. And again, this is the dude who soul crack in our community. Who again, it's like he knows stuff about the game. He's trying to reform himself, but he's an LA dude.
Wow.
Everybody knows Rick Ross is an LA dude. So why is his nonprofit getting money to do work in Illinois? And here's the way that I have kind of like made sense of it. When you're in Illinois, you control this pot of money. You're hooking up your homies. You're hooking up the YMCA.
Right.
To do after-school programming like playing basketball and calling that violence prevention, which I think is ridiculous, but that's what they actually got money for. And what you're saying is that, well, no, I hooked up people who have real grassroots credibility. I gave money to Rick Ross's nonprofit. And Rick Ross is in the streets. Everybody knows that.
Wow.
And it serves as political cover to make you look like you actually have a grassroots methodology, mm-hmm. when you're really just beefing up the nonprofit industrial complex.
Yeah.
And again, these are people who support local political machines. These are people that support the Democratic Party. And these are people who largely have a vision of reparations that does not center a bottom-up grassroots approach to Black autonomous institution building. So to kind of wrap up, I mean, I've talked a lot about H.R. 40 kind of by proxy.
Because
mm-hmm. I know that's what most people think of when they think of reparations. It's a big national initiative that, again, I think has this cachet around we just got to make them see our suffering. And somehow, mm-hmm. some way, if they saw how much we've suffered, they will do something to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not reparations for me.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the 60s, the mentality was you took all the money in terms of the nationalist community, the Pan-Africanist ethos, which is the Black people have been expropriated of our wealth, expropriated of our human capital. And we do not view integration into the system you built on our backs as liberation.
Mm-hmm.
You've accumulated the resources. You must reinvest them in our community to give us the autonomy to not need you anymore. But the Democratic Party has an incentive to flip the script, to basically harness the anger and frustration Black people feel about our current state to try to sell us that, no, inclusion into the dominant system is the new version of reparations.
Mm.
That's why I can get into the 2020 presidential primary conversation.
Right.
And if we allow them to sell us that vision of reparations, we're going to be continuously stuck begging for access to a system that was built on our backs and for our exclusion. And we're going to miss opportunities like what's happening in Maryland right now. My guess is a lot of people in the audience are actually in Maryland. So if you're in PG County, Montgomery County, there is a statewide effort to make cannabis legalization the most radical bottom-up grassroots version possible. To kind of finish answering your question, having things like participatory budgeting at a local level and then having a grassroots political push to force local political officials to honor the will of the community. That's kind of what they did in Jackson, Mississippi. That's what we've done in Baltimore with the Baltimore City Children and Youth Fund.
Mm-hmm.
That can actually solve the problem of having the money trapped in the state capital when no one knows what's going mm-hmm. on and technocrats controlling everything.
Right.
Now, I think people intuitively feel, and it's true, that local political officials are not inherently revolutionary and not inherently caring what the people say, but they are more susceptible to pressure. Their districts are just like inherently smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So one person's anger at you means a lot more when you win an election of 1,000 votes, as many of these city council people do, compared to 5,000-10,000 votes, as many of these state representatives do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a methodology not of simple, cathartic, recognize the suffering liberation. Our vision of policy is create space for people at the bottom up, the people who are actually impacted by the war on drugs, grassroots, mm-hmm. working class Black people who've been in jail. No people who carry guns, no people who were deeply involved in what people feel like is the heart of the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
To get them, they know that city council person. They may not like him, he may be kind of shady, or she might be kind of shady, but they know that they can put pressure on them if they need to.
Mm-hmm.
And by putting the money at a local level, as opposed to trapping it in Annapolis, and again, folks, I don't think are nefarious, but they truly believe that if I have an expert with a degree, they will know what to do with that money better than somebody at the city council in Baltimore. And I think we just got to be honest with like a lot of people who call themselves progressives really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I think Elizabeth Warren and a lot of her people might actually believe that, but they don't say that in public.
Mm-hmm.
What they say in public is, here's my reparations plan. The result would be the nonprofit industrial complex and the people who have degrees running everything.
Right.
And you should be happy because we're going to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
We as the technocratic elite are going to do reparations for you. That's not what we do. What LBS is doing is that give us the money and the power to do it ourselves. And it's an approach that comes out of that Pan-African Black National Liberation tradition that we've applied in Baltimore and that we're trying to apply statewide.
I think that's an excellent layout. If you could just recap really briefly as we close out and just name those four myths that are really pervasive. Mm-hmm.
The first myth is the mythology of everyone who resists cannabis legalization is inherently conservative.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of legitimate concerns. I mean, one thing we didn't bring up was, again, like, methadone as an example of a policy where the government basically kind of becomes your drug pusher.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have good intentions, like getting people off of heroin, but it makes people dependent upon a system where if they were to backlash against the government and be more radical, mm-hmm. they could cut people off for that methadone.
Right.
So people like Matulu Shakur, who again is a political prisoner that many of our viewers might know, his whole thing was using acupuncture as an alternative to methadone. Mm. Now, who are the people doing those indigenous methodologies for addiction today?
Mm-hmm.
And can they get funded? Probably not, mm-hmm. because of the hegemony of the public health industrial complex. So there are people who resist cannabis legalization because they want to see what you're doing about that.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing about people like Matulu Shakur in jail. How you going to have a harm reduction movement and Matulu Shakur still in jail?
Right.
Right. And so a lot of people who say they're against cannabis legalization, that's what they're really saying. But we can't hear it because I think people have not been conditioned to hear that. So briefly, the second myth was the myth around procedural technocratic reparations.
Mm-hmm.
All we got to do is let the non-violent drug offenders out. It's not that simple.
Right.
Because people do be carrying guns and people be overcharged.
Right.
And you got to actually build a movement to apply pressure to get them out.
And the impact would be very small. Like 5 to 6%.
Again, the reality is that most non-violent drug offenders who got caught for simple possession,
mm-hmm.
they don't do a lot of time in the state system.
Mm-hmm.
And that the federal system has changed a lot over the past 10 years. A lot of them are out of the federal system now. So the third myth is the one about the black capitalist mythology of reparations, which is if we just got the bag and got to run the industry, all the people in the hood would actually be good.
Mm-hmm.
The way the industry works is not amenable to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is big top-down capitalist corporations, a few very rich black people
mm-hmm.
could get access to the industry. Can they make enough jobs downstream that working class black people who were impacted by the war on drugs can actually get that's going to be good for them? Probably not. Now, that doesn't mean that it's inherently wrong, in my opinion. For some people, it might be. But there are other more accessible economic opportunities that are oftentimes we don't give the money to incubate those opportunities because
mm-hmm.
you have to invest in grassroots working class black people who mm-hmm. are adjacent to those people. You have to give them the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the political establishment doesn't want to get the people who have connections to working class black people millions of dollars because they're not politically accountable to the Democratic
right.
Party.
Right.
Or they're accountable to a branch of the Democratic Party that's not the dominant branch in power. So giving those people money to incubate a black-run transportation network that could keep Uber out or to run a social consumption space where we can have parties and performances and people who are in public housing or in their apartment and they can't legally smoke in their public housing or apartment need a place to consume legally. They mm-hmm. can't consume on the street even post-legalization. So these are all opportunities that need to be incubated that are far less intensive in terms of capital that could really make a difference in terms of working class black folks having economic benefits
mm-hmm.
that are not focused on because we're too busy focused on the millionaires becoming the next cannabis tycoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last one, obviously, is the progressive, multicultural, big state reparations theory, which is, I think, so indicative of what people want to believe that if we just had more money, the problem would be solved. Not recognizing the people who control the money have an incentive to not just not invest in our indigenous methodologies, but like actually pathologize them and attack them, because that secures their hold over the industry of servicing black people, the industry of servicing addiction, the industry of servicing public health. It's actually an incentive or just ignorance about the culture of black people that leads what gets invested in to not only not reflect our needs, but to actually be antagonistic to the indigenous institutions and indigenous methodologies that we need to help survive. So again, if you're in Maryland, these are issues that are impacting you every day. It's not HR 40, it's not Evanston, but it's a big statewide issue that if we're not active on the issue, Maryland's gonna go the way of Illinois and have a very nice looking, very well talked about program by the media that's not going to really fulfill the needs that I think most of the people watching this video would truly feel needs to be done. So we hope that you continue to engage Black Power Media. We'd like to continue to have these conversations as Maryland and the rest of the country rolls out cannabis legalization. And we look forward to hopefully you continue to plug in with LBS, Leads a Beautiful Struggle, in Baltimore and statewide, fighting for different issues related to community empowerment. And we hope you continue to be with us here on this channel as we continue to go in search of Black Power. See you soon.
Bye.